We welcome you now to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, the collaborative series between 98.7 WFMT, Chicago Magazine, and Looking Glass Theater Company in the Water Tower Waterworks. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by the Seminary Co-op Bookstores. We go now to the stage of the Looking Glass Theater. Victoria's guest today is Elizabeth Kostova, the author of The Historian. Here's Victoria Lautman.
Thank you. Thank you. Good afternoon. Welcome to, I guess I should say good evening, under the circumstances. Welcome to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman. This is a monthly free author interview series. As many of you know, a joint collaboration between Chicago Magazine, WFMT Radio, and always set live here at Looking Glass Theater, where we are on the set of Sitaram, which is sold out and which you could go and see now only if you really begged somebody and if you became a member maybe immediately of their future programming. You can be sure to get in on all of these kinds of great productions. We're very indebted to Looking Glass to have this series here. We're going to take questions at the end of this show, and I know a lot of you I see have brought books with you, The Historian. My guest today is Elizabeth Kostova, and we'll be taking a break halfway through, and I'm sort of like thinking back now to, for some reason, this image in my mind came about the kinds of bedtime stories that my parents read to me when I was, I don't know, 7, 8 years old, and I'm thinking of really pretty banal things, Cinderella, Jack and the Beanstalk. Occasionally, my father would come in and read to me Casey at the Bat. And I bring this up because Elizabeth Kostova, at age 7, was not getting that type of bedtime story. For about 6 months, traveling with her father through Eastern Europe, she got to hear stories about Dracula. Yeah, and it made a big impression. She marinated these stories, thought about them for something like 2 decades in her mind, the stories her father told her about Dracula. And at some point, this impact took itself to the next level, and she decided very specifically that she was going to write a book. I think at that moment, she probably didn't realize that it was going to take 10 years of her life and untold hours of research. But what better way than to pay an homage to one of your parents and their storytelling ability? When The Historian was published last year, it was a huge bestseller. It had caused a frenzy of bidding before it was, while it was sold. It garnered $2 million in advance. The movie rights were sold. It's been published in 38 languages, I think Elizabeth told me today. It's a fabulous retelling and reimagining of the Dracula myth. It is my great pleasure to welcome Elizabeth Kostova. Thank you. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hello. Good evening.
Good evening. I had to say it, and it is in the book, and I love that it was in the book. There was actually a very specific moment that you decided to write this book, and it wasn't watching Bela Lugosi or even, you know, somebody like Tom Cruise or any of the other movie vampires that have appeared. It was traveling in one of the most beautiful places on earth with your husband and dog, looking out onto a beautiful vista. What was it about that led you to write a book about Dracula and Vlad the Impaler? What was the connection?
Well, I think books usually don't get started in a single moment, but this one did. And that moment was when I was out hiking about 11 years ago with my husband in the mountains of North Carolina. And I had traveled and worked and researched a lot in Eastern Europe before that. And I think there was something about coming out to the top of a mountain with this gorgeous panorama that reminded me of being in the Balkans. The Balkans are a land of mountains, and although I didn't realize that at the time, I think it gave me that sort of sense of having been in this place before, but in a very different part of the world. And at that moment, I suddenly remembered my father's tales in Eastern Europe. And I think I should hasten to add that my father is a very nice man. I know this sounds like child abuse that you would tell a 7-year-old stories about Dracula, but they were wonderful stories. They were kind of pleasantly creepy retellings of those great Hollywood movies from the 30s and 40s that he grew up with. So in his stories, there was always a creaking castle door and steps going down to a crypt, and the valiant Englishman always went out in the end. And so it was very, very much based on those great movies. So at that moment in the mountains, I suddenly had this almost vision of a father telling a young daughter stories about Dracula. And although I had thought about this many times over the years, and Dracula was really associated for me with travel and with beautiful historic places, I really had never thought about turning this into fiction. And in that moment, I envisioned a novel that would be a story within a story. The father and daughter's travels to all these places my father and I had been, my family and I, and places I had been as an adult as well. But then the father's story within that, and of course the question, why is he telling these stories? And I knew that, it would have to be something more than entertaining a bored seven-year-old on a train. It would have to be about something really important connected with history. So within about a week, I started working on the novel. And I have to say, it's a really good thing you don't know when you start a project that it could take 10 years, because you would certainly quit in the first 3 weeks.
Well, you just mentioned this one question that came to your mind. How do you sustain a story about Dracula that isn't just about telling a kid a story? And you said somewhere that every novel begins with questions. So presumably one question, that question led to other questions. I was just curious, what were like the top five? What were the big hit questions that you had to pose to yourself and get past in writing this book?
Well, I suppose the central question is the one I just mentioned for me, that question of why would these stories have some urgency for this character, the father? And another question, in a way, was who is Dracula? We know there really are two separate Draculas, as the historian discusses, and one, of course, is the Bram Stoker supernatural creation, the vampire, and the other one is the real prince of Wallachia in the 15th century, an historical personage with a pretty bad record. And I wanted to explore these connections between history and legend. And so another question for me was, what could Dracula represent about the history of this region of Eastern Europe that has been invaded and occupied by many different cultures and enriched by them in many ways, too? And I suppose one question after a while was, when am I ever going to finish this thing?
How do I get out of this project now? Well, you didn't answer that for 10 years, but it was worth it after a while. I figure you, right around year eight, you probably became very, I would just think, completely sick of the entire process.
Well, you know, I did have moments when I felt, I wondered if I would become one of those old ladies who goes to parties and says, oh, let me tell you about my novel, and everyone clears the room. She's been working on that for 40 years. But actually, I never felt that I wouldn't finish it. I was so determined to finish a novel. This is my first novel, and for a fiction writer who wants to write novels as well as short stories, it's a big step and challenge. So I have to say, too, you can get tired of your own work, your own project, and your own writing, your own project in itself. But I felt that I could never get tired of history. History is the most endlessly fascinating story. It's the ultimate human story. So although there were days when I thought, I really have to sit with these characters again. Are they going to do anything good today? I also felt this joy of research. And I know many of you are interested in history, and there's a way in which history is a pleasure just because it's inexhaustible.
This is a book that, in spite of its, I don't know, 650 or something pages, I mean, it's enormous. And I know people have commented on, how could I start to read this? I need 2 months. And it goes very quickly. I don't know if there's people here who haven't read it or are considering reading it. You get drawn into this book so quickly, and you read a note to the reader, which I actually, it thanks various people at one point, all of whom I looked up on the internet, none of whom exist, but you're so sucked in from like the first paragraph that you're, and that note is actually dated in the future, 2008. So you're right away thinking, why is this note taking place in the future? Who are these people? And then chapter one grabs you. And Elizabeth is going to read from that now. The very, very beginning of the book. And for those of you who haven't read it, I think you're going to want to know what happens next. Elizabeth Kostova, the historian.
In 1972, I was 16. Young, my father said, to be traveling with him on his diplomatic missions. He preferred to know that I was sitting attentively in class at the International School of Amsterdam. In those days, his foundation was based in Amsterdam, and it had been my home for so long that I had nearly forgotten our early life in the United States. It seems peculiar to me now that I should have been so obedient well into my teens, while the rest of my generation was experimenting with drugs and protesting the imperialist war in Vietnam. But I had been raised in a world so sheltered that it makes my adult life in academia look positively adventurous. To begin with, I was motherless, and the care that my father took of me had been deepened by a double sense of responsibility, so that he protected me more completely than he might have otherwise. My mother had died when I was a baby, before my father founded the Center for Peace and Democracy. My father never spoke of her and turned quietly away if I asked questions. I understood very young that this was a topic too painful for him to discuss. Instead, he took excellent care of me himself and provided me with a series of governesses and housekeepers. Money was not an object with him where my upbringing was concerned, although we lived simply enough from day to day. The latest of these housekeepers was Mrs. Clay, who took care of our narrow 17th century townhouse on the Raumgracht, a canal in the heart of the old city. Mrs. Clay let me in after school every day and was a surrogate parent when my father traveled, which was often. She was English, older than my mother would have been, skilled with a feather duster and clumsy with teenagers. Sometimes, looking at her too compassionate, long-toothed face over the dining table, I felt she must be thinking of my mother, and I hated her for it. When my father was away, the handsome house echoed. No one could help me with my algebra. No one admired my new coat or told me to come here and give him a hug or expressed shock over how tall I had grown. When my father returned from some name on the European map that hung on the wall in our dining room, he smelled like other times and places, spicy and tired. We took our vacations in Paris or Rome, diligently studying the landmarks my father thought I should see. But I longed for those other places he disappeared to, those strange old places I had never been. While he was gone, I went back and forth to school, dropping my books on the polished hall table with a bang. Neither Mrs. Clay nor my father let me go out in the evenings, except to the occasional carefully approved movie with carefully approved friends. And to my retrospective astonishment, I never flouted these rules. I preferred solitude anyway. It was the medium in which I had been raised, in which I swam comfortably. I excelled at my studies, but not in my social life. Girls my age terrified me, especially the tough-talking, chain-smoking sophisticates of our diplomatic circle. Around them, I always felt that my dress was too long or too short, or that I should have been wearing something else entirely. Boys mystified me, although I dreamed vaguely of men. In fact, I was happiest alone in my father's library, a large, fine room on the first floor of our house. My father's library had probably once been a sitting room, but he sat down only to read, and he considered a large library more important than a large living room. He had long since given me free run of his collection. During his absences, I spent hours doing my homework at the mahogany desk or browsing the shelves that lined every wall. I understood later that my father had either half forgotten what was on one of the top shelves, or more likely, assumed I would never be able to reach it. Late one night I took down not only a translation of the Kama Sutra, but also a much older volume and an envelope of yellowing papers. I can't say even now what made me pull them down, but the image I saw at the center of the book, the smell of age that rose from it, and my discovery that the papers were personal letters all caught my attention forcibly. I knew I shouldn't examine my father's private papers or anyone's, and I was also afraid that Mrs. Clay might suddenly come in to dust the dustless desk. That must have been what made me look over my shoulder at the door. But I couldn't help reading the first paragraph of the topmost letter, holding it for a couple of minutes as I stood near the shelves. December 12, 1930, Trinity College, Oxford. My dear and unfortunate successor, it is with regret that I imagine you, whoever you are, reading the account I must put down here. The regret is partly for myself, because I will surely be at least in trouble, maybe dead, or perhaps worse, if this is in your hands. But my regret is also for you, my yet unknown friend, because only by someone who needs such vile information will this letter someday be read. If you are not my successor in some other sense, you will soon be my heir, and I feel sorrow at bequeathing to another human being my own perhaps unbelievable experience of evil. Why I myself inherited it, I don't know, but I hope to discover that fact eventually, perhaps in the course of writing to you, or perhaps in the course of further events.
Elizabeth Kostova, reading from The Historian. And with that, we're off and running into an incredibly complicated, dense, history-packed story that encompasses so many things. But at the core of it is Dracula and the possibility or reality of his existence, and the real-life model for Dracula, Vlad the Impaler. Vlad Tepes, is it pronounced?
Tepes.
Mm-hmm. You referenced Bram Stoker in the book several times, and it was Stoker who I think originally in the 19th century really conflated the two, who for all time put them together as really Dracula himself. But it was really Vlad in the 15th century, the prince you mentioned, who was the real-life precursor. Now, at the time you began to do the research for this book, did you know that much about Vlad, or did you have to discover it as you went along?
Well, I had heard or read somewhere that there was a real person, a real historical figure behind the Dracula name, and I didn't know very much about him. So very early in writing the book, I decided I wanted it to be more about history than the supernatural, although it would include this supernatural tradition. And so I began doing a lot of research, and I was fascinated to find that Vlad the Impaler is actually one of the better documented medieval leaders of his period, partly because he was reviled in pamphlets by some of the ethnic groups he cleansed in what's now Romania. People had a lot to say about him. So there is actually a lot of documentation of him, and some of his own letters still exist. I've never seen them in the original, but I've read translations of them, and they're fascinating. They are very official, but they show an extremely confident, almost flamboyant, charismatic personality.
But it was really the bloodthirstiness of this actual person that, and the fact that his name derives from an actual term, right, that caused people to really put the two of them together and then eventually became vampire-related. I mean, at the time, nobody accused him of being a vampire. They just thought he was a bloodthirsty, sadistic, horrible monster, but not a vampire. Everything else.
Right, exactly. And actually, it's doubtful that Bram Stoker knew that much about him. Stoker never traveled to Eastern Europe, and he wrote amazingly vivid descriptions in the novel Dracula of the East European landscape that Vlad the Impaler actually inhabited. So that novel is a great tribute to the power of armchair research in a lot of ways. It has its inaccuracies too, but it's wonderfully vivid. But it's doubtful that he knew that much about Dracula's reign because he didn't have access to a lot of the documents that would have told him a lot about it. What he knew was that this was a noble name and that it was the name of someone who had been instrumental in holding back the Ottoman Empire from that part of Eastern Europe, and also that it was somehow connected with both colorful and sinister events. But he may not have known much more than that.
One of the things that I thought from a psychological standpoint in your book, that you, the way that you present Dracula as a person, you have a lot of choices about whether to portray this person as, well, as anything, as a monster, as a seductor, as somebody who has no humanity left, as somebody slightly sympathetic. And I thought because you bring out the historical truth about the person behind the legend, and that we discover, which I didn't know, I mean, I knew a cursory amount about Vlad the Impaler, but that as a young child, as like a, I don't know, I think he was like 7 years old or something, 8 years old, he was given by his father as a hostage to the Pasha of Constantinople, the big enemy, basically as a way of sealing the deal that Vlad's dad, the original Dracula, if we could call him that, Vlad, I mean, he was called Vlad Dracul, right? That his dad basically said, I will not wage war on you, and as proof of that, here's my kid and his kid brother, and you just keep him over there in Constantinople, and that will be proof. To me, if you were going to interpret this from a psychological standpoint today, the idea of like total paternal abandonment at an early age, you know, being raised by the enemy, seeing torture on a daily basis, they were kept in terrible conditions. Of course you're going to turn out like, you know, a Jeffrey Dahmer type person. It seems to me you spend a certain amount of time in the book making us sympathetic with that side of Vlad and Dracula.
Well, this technique of leaving a family member as a hostage in these situations was not uncommon in the Middle Ages. And I think you're right, it does show power as a priority over family happiness. But it certainly was not unknown. And it must have been truly a terrible childhood. I think, on the other hand, many children were used as pawns in that era and did not become sadistic murderers of tens of thousands of people. So I think there's no way we can know what creates that kind of personality. But we do know that power in its ultimate forms tends to corrupt, as Machiavelli said. And Vlad Dracula is a particularly gruesome example of that.
Did you have to really think about, in the writing of this book, though, the way you wanted us to perceive this character? I mean, the big buildup. I mean, there's so many things going on and so many characters who are just so compelling. There's a love story. There's two love stories really going on in the book. But it's all essentially about Dracula that everybody's chasing and trying to prove the existence of and trying to figure out where he's buried and if he's still alive. You could have ended this book in any number of ways, and you ended it in a very hopeful way, I think, as opposed to a really creepy, horrible way. You could have gone in many different directions, and you took a certain amount of care to present Dracula as a very smart, egomaniacal guy, but somebody who, to a certain extent, could be related to. And I'm curious about that choice.
Well, that was a very deliberate choice. One of the things that I wanted to explore in the book is the question of whether, the kind of awful question actually, of whether a person can be completely evil or not, or whether everyone is in some way a mix, whether someone who is a kind of political monster might also remain a human being. And I don't know the answer to those questions, but this was a kind of exploration. I really wanted the book to be not only a sort of dark story of history, but also a book about family love and attachment and loyalty, about love and passion, and about the courage that the characters have to bring to these very unusual and difficult situations. I think we see over and over in history that human beings act in extraordinarily courageous ways sometimes when they're put in terrible political, historical situations. And that's something that moves and fascinates me. And I really wanted the ending of the book to reflect some hope, too, because of that.
There was one moment in the book, and I'm sure anybody who's here who's read it probably experienced the same thing, because it is, there are so many stories within stories, and like a really great 19th century book, or like somebody, I was thinking of Umberto Eco, The Name of the Rose, or A.S. Byatt, Possession, Charles Dickens himself, all of these things came through my mind as I was reading this, and quite literally trying to keep track of who is telling the story at any given point. In fact, the woman at the start, who we hear from in 2008, and then we meet as a 16-year-old, we never discover her name. It doesn't become important, but it's one of the things that I think in going through the book, one has to constantly be aware of what the point of view is. There are letters, there are documents, there are people quoting letters in other letters. And I wondered if I was having a hard time keeping track of what level of the story we're in, how were you as a writer doing that? You couldn't have just done that out of your head.
No, certainly. I really am.
Or if you did, you know, great. But
no, there was no way. No, I love that form of especially Victorian novels that have stories within stories, and I really wanted to give it a try. But I have to admit, it would have been too much to keep together mentally all the time, especially when I was about halfway through the book and I already had 6 characters' lives to juggle. So at about that point, I made myself a giant chart for my office wall, on which I could look up the part of the book I was writing, the information I wanted to convey in that section, who was telling the story, and what form it would be told in, whether that story would be told in letters or perhaps the story of someone else is telling one of the characters. So eventually I had to kind of resort to this big chart that I kept on my wall for about 5 years.
Where is that chart? Boy, on eBay, you could do really well with that chart. Have you thought about it? Right before the movie comes out.
As soon as I was really done with the book, I tore it off my wall and put up something nicer looking.
Well, we're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to read another section from the book. It was actually really hard to figure out what to get Elizabeth to read because there are so many conversations that I thought, well, we won't be able to track that. But this letter, I mean, there's so many layers in the book that finding something that can sort of clue people in without giving away anything. But I think I came up with a great segment later on that's part travelogue, part history, and part pure Dracula. So don't go away. You're listening to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman.
This is 98.7 WFMT Chicago. This local broadcast of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman is made possible in part by the Seminary Co-op Bookstores, 3 Chicago bookstores with 1 world-class reputation. Come to the Seminary Co-op Bookstores, 3 Chicago bookstores with 1 world-class reputation. In beautiful Hyde Park, 57th Street Books at 1301 East 57th Street is where serious readers go for fun. Enjoy a wide selection of titles in a unique space that's perfect for browsing. Specialties include literature, mysteries, children's books, cookbooks, and travel. The Newberry Library Bookstore at 60 West Walton carries a distinctive selection of books, cards, and gifts in a beautiful landmark setting. Specialties include Native American studies, history, genealogy, cartography, calligraphy, and music. And the Seminary Co-op at 5757 South University Avenue, across from the University of Chicago Quad, enjoys a reputation as one of the best academic bookstores anywhere. Known for the breadth and depth of its inventory, the Co-op carries more than 100,000 titles in a wide range of disciplines. Visit the Seminary Co-op bookstores in person. Call toll-free 800-777-1456 or look up semcoop.com. Each month, the featured author of Writers on the Record will be the subject of a brief Q&A written by Victoria Lautman for Chicago Magazine. Both the magazine and 98.7 WFMT will announce upcoming interviews, which take place once a month, Sundays at noon, at the Looking Glass Theater. Our next broadcast of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman will take place on Sunday, April 30th, when Victoria's guest will be Jay McInerney, author of The Good Life. If you'd like to be in the audience for that discussion, please call 312-832-6789 to make a reservation, and admission is free. We return now to Chicago's Looking Glass Theater and our live broadcast of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman. Elizabeth Kostova, author of The Historian, is Victoria's guest today.
Thank you. Welcome back, Writers on the Record. I'm Victoria Lautman, and I want to remind you, you should put on your calendars now the next three, the last, actually, authors of the second season of Writers on the Record. On April 30th, Jay McInerney coming here to talk about his new book. Peter Carey is coming on May 21st, one of only two people who've ever won the Booker Prize twice. Julia Glass is going to be here June 11th. She was the author of the National Book Award winning Three Junes. She's got a new book coming out. Then we're going to take a little break over the summer. And then in September, Mary Gateskill, whose paperback version of Veronica we're going to be talking about here. So make sure you mark your calendars for that. But today, more important than any of that, we are talking with Elizabeth Kostova about her best-selling book, The Historian. And one of the things that just grabbed me in the book was how you could really have a second career as a travel writer. Your descriptions of places, whether Ragusa or Venice or Holland, really any place that you bit off in this book, I'm assuming you had to have been there, or your level of imagining these places was just sublime. And your ability to be able to translate that experience into something, I really never thought I would care about reading a description of, you know, some coastal fishing village, but you make those places come alive. And I guess one of my questions now is, have you been to all the places listed in the book, or were you an armchair traveler on our behalf?
Well, both. Actually, I had been to all but a couple of the places that are described in the book, and many of them I had traveled through or even lived in for a while. But during the 10 years when I was writing the book, I didn't have time or money at all to go anywhere, basically. And I was working very hard as an instructor. I had many classes to teach, constant work. So in a way, this was armchair retravel. It was kind of like that wonderful experience you have when you get out an album from a trip you particularly loved years ago, and you look through it and you remember all kinds of things you've forgotten. Whenever I was working with my own travel memories, though, I always did a lot of research anyway, because I don't know about you, but I don't trust my memory that much. And I wanted to make sure that I was writing very, very accurately about places. Of course, in a lot of cases, I wrote about real places, but I changed their names so that I had a tiny bit of fictional freedom as well.
One of the places that was most compelling, not just because of your description of it, but in the events going on there, but because of a particular person, was its tiny Bulgarian village where all these folks end up, again, looking. They think they're going to nab Dracula at this, I think it's Botchkovo or something in Bulgaria, or it's close to Botchkovo. Maybe it's even a little or smaller town than Botchkovo, Bulgaria. And there's a woman there in that town whose name is Babiyanka. And they go to this woman who apparently looks like she's like Ramses II. She looks like she's 95 or 10,000 years old, but she's really only 50. And she sings for them. And your description, not just of the village and of Babiyanka going through this fire-walking ceremony, carrying an icon, but of her singing was really phenomenal, made me want to listen to her. And then I read that you'd actually spent a fair amount of time studying Bulgarian singing at one point. So you've actually lived some of these things in a completely different life, presumably.
Yes, I actually first went to Bulgaria in 1989 on a fellowship to study Bulgarian music, traditional music. And I was there for 6 months with a couple of American colleagues who were also amateur ethnomusicologists. And we went to all these incredible villages and made a collection of audio tapes that are now at the Library of Congress in Bosnia, Bulgaria, and in Russia. And it was a transforming experience. And it was also the year the Berlin Wall fell. We arrived in Bulgaria 7 days after the longtime dictator there had been put under house arrest. So it was a really tumultuous, interesting, fascinating time to be there. And people in Bulgaria were willing to talk with us in a way that they probably wouldn't have been able to about 6 months earlier. And we did hear this incredible live singing, which is completely unlike anything we have in Western traditions, and it's very, very haunting and kind of harsh-sounding music.
So I have to think that your husband, who is also Bulgarian, that these scenes behind the Iron Curtain, you notice how her smile just got bigger? These scenes behind the Iron Curtain describing this, you know, wonderful, slow-moving but very passionate love affair between Helen and Paul, or Elena, I should say, that all of these descriptions of them traipsing around and in bugged rooms and everything really was kind of an account of you and Gheorghe, your husband?
Well, I thought when I started the novel that I was writing a novel as far as possible from my own life, you know, Dracula. And this was not from personal experience. But I think it's also impossible to write a novel that doesn't somehow draw on your own experience. And I realized while I was writing it that that particular love story does have a lot of resonance for me. And I was laughing when you said that because when I met my husband in 1989, he hated Bulgarian folk music. Bulgarian folk music had been used by the communist regime as kind of nationalist propaganda. And whenever he heard it on the radio, he would turn the radio off. So through me, he learned to love the traditional music of his country, and he taught me to be a little less hostile toward Pink Floyd.
Well, I want you to read another section of the book that I'm not even sure that I can describe. This is in one of the letters, I think, right, from the girl's father to her, or is this a conversation that he's having with her? I can't even remember. I got so drawn into it, but it's a section that kind of, I think, shows people who aren't familiar with this book how deft you are at melding history, place, the past, the present, references to politics, to just sort of all the kinds of things that have gone into the mix of this book. But can you set it up a little bit before you read it?
Sure, yeah. It actually is from a long series of letters that the father in the book, Paul, leaves for his daughter and to tell her about his life and travels and his quest for the truth about Dracula. And in this scene, he has gone to Istanbul for the first time in his life looking for some documents, some clues to Dracula's past and also to some other burning questions that I won't give away here. And in it, he describes what he's doing. And I should also just say for the audience out there that Professor Rossi is mentioned in this too. And part of Paul's quest is to find out what has happened to his mentor, Professor Rossi. It seemed a good opportunity to see something else in Istanbul, so I made my way toward the maze-like domed Topkapı Palace complex, commissioned by Sultan Mehmed as the new seat of his conquest. It had drawn me both from a distance and in my guidebook since our first afternoon in the city. The Topkapı covers a large area on the headland of Istanbul and is guarded on three sides by water, the Bosphorus, the Golden Horn, and the Marmara. I suspected that if I missed it, I would be missing the essence of Istanbul's Ottoman history. Perhaps I was strolling far afield from Rossi once again, but I reflected that Rossi himself would have done the same with a few hours of enforced idleness. I was disappointed to learn as I wandered the parks, courtyards, and pavilions where the heart of the empire had pulsed for hundreds of years, that little from Mehmed's time was on exhibit there, little apart from some ornaments from his treasury and some of his swords, nicked and scarred from prodigious use. I think I had hoped more than anything to catch another glimpse of the Sultan whose army had battled Vlad Dracula's and whose police courts had been concerned about the security of Dracula's alleged tomb in Snagov. It was rather, I thought, remembering the old men's game in the bazaar, like trying to determine the position of your opponent's shah in shachmat by knowing only the position of your own. There was plenty in the palace to keep my thoughts busy, however. According to what Helen had told me the day before, this was a world in which more than 5,000 servants, with titles such as Great Turban Winder, had once served the will of the Sultan, where eunuchs guarded the virtue of his enormous harem in what amounted to an ornate prison, where Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent, reigning in the mid-16th century, had consolidated the empire, codified its laws, and made Istanbul as glorious a metropolis as it had been under the Byzantine emperors. Like them, the Sultan traveled out into his city once a week to worship at Hagia Sophia, but on Friday, the Muslim holy day, not Sunday. It was a world of rigid protocol and sumptuous dining, of marvelous textiles and sensuously beautiful tile work, of viziers in green and chamberlains in red, of fantastically colored boots and towering turbans. I had been particularly struck by Helen's description of the Janissaries, a crack corps of guards selected from the ranks of captured boys from all over the empire. I knew I had read about them before, these boys born Christian in places like Serbia and Wallachia, and raised in Islam, trained in hatred of the very peoples they sprang from, and unleashed on those peoples when they reached manhood, like falcons to the kill. I had seen images of the Janissaries somewhere, in fact, perhaps in a book of paintings. Thinking about their expressionless young faces, masked to protect the Sultan, I felt the chill of the palace buildings deepening around me. It occurred to me as I moved from room to room that the young Vlad Dracula would have made an excellent Janissary. The empire had missed an opportunity there, a chance to harness a little more cruelty to its enormous force. They would have had to catch him quite young, I thought, perhaps to have kept him in Asia Minor instead of returning him to his father. He had been too independent after that, a renegade, loyal to no one but himself, as quick to execute his own followers as he was to kill his Turkish enemies. Like Stalin, I surprised myself with this mental leap as I gazed out at the glint of the Bosphorus. Stalin had died the year before, and new tales of his atrocities had leaked into the Western press. I remembered one report about an apparently loyal general whom Stalin had accused just before the war of wanting to overthrow him. The general had been removed from his apartment in the middle of the night and hung upside down from the beams of a busy railway station outside Moscow for several days until he died. The passengers getting on and off the trains had all seen him, but no one had dared to glance twice in his direction. Much later, the people in that neighborhood had not been able to agree on whether or not this had even happened. That sort of disturbing thought followed me from room to marvelous room throughout the palace. Everywhere I sensed something sinister or perilous, which could simply have been the overwhelming evidence of the Sultan's supreme power, a power not so much concealed as revealed by the narrow corridors, twisting passages, barred windows, cloistered gardens. At last, seeking a little relief from the mingled sensuality and imprisonment, the elegance and the oppression, I wandered back outside to the sunlit trees of the outer court.
Elizabeth Kostova, the historian. Such beautiful writing. It's just so beautiful. And I was thinking, as you were reading that and thinking about your reference to Lake Snagov and the various places that this book has been translated, 38 languages, how is it going to play in Romania? Didn't they just translate one over there?
Well, it's actually coming out in Romania today. This weekend.
Well, we'll raise a toast.
Yeah. And so I haven't heard yet what if anything is happening with
but
it.
Is there sort of a cultural difference where it
there
goes?
It is a very, to me, a very important translation of the book, because Vlad III, Vlad Tepes, is a very complicated figure there. On the one hand, many of his really cruel deeds are acknowledged. On the other hand, he is also a national hero there because of his role in holding back the Ottoman Empire, and because he was raised to hero status not only by folk legends, but very much by the communist regime that ruled there for 40 years. So he was actually on a postage stamp in Romania in the 70s to commemorate an anniversary of his death. So he's a complicated figure, and many Romanian historians are very protective of him. On the other hand, others are genuinely interested in exploring the complexities of that kind of figure. And I don't know what the response will be there. I know that it has been very good leading up to the book, and that there's a lot of publicity for it. But we'll see.
Are you going to be traveling there, too?
I hope to visit in the summer. I'd really like to go there and meet with people.
Well, I noticed there's a website for the Transylvania Society of Dracula. You might want to make an appearance there. That was founded in 1991, and there's a Canadian chapter of it from 1995. There seems to be quite the tourist industry around Dracula now, even though, I mean, technically, at least your book shows that Romania is not where he wound up. Everything else was really happening in Bulgaria.
Well, actually, he lived in what is part of now Romania. Transylvania and Wallachia are regions of Romania. The Bulgarian part of the story is my addition. So the way that the medieval story works in this book, and this is something that people frequently ask me about, because I think we're all curious with a historical novel, what part is truth and what part is history. In this book, all of the history of Vlad Dracula up through the real historical mystery of his grave and why it is empty, which is something we'll probably never know in reality, up through that part of the story, all of that is carefully researched, carefully documented. As far as we can know, it's ascertained. But from there, I invented a story of something that could have happened. It's plausible, it's researched, but of course it didn't.
It sucked me right in, lady. It sucked me right in.
Well, good. Maybe I
and
shouldn't,
I'm happy
maybe
to
I shouldn't have told you.
It's all right. It just shows me how talented you are. This would be a good moment for anybody who is interested in asking a question to approach either of the two microphones. Don't be shy. It's just us here. But definitely come down and ask a question. You may never have this opportunity again. And while people are massing behind the microphones, you know, the movie that's going to be made of this, which I know you're deeply interested in, and really hoping that they're not going to go again for somebody like Tom Cruise, but for somebody really legitimately of the area. I mean, when you're reading this and there's descriptions of Dracula in it, I said to you, it's as though I would recognize him if he was shopping for creme de la mer at Saks or something. He's so specific. And you, I can't imagine that you would be happy with a version of this book that didn't incorporate people from the real places that Dracula lived and walked.
Well, the studio that bought this story, Red Wagon, which is part of Sony, they seem very committed to filming on location and to trying to give this something of an authentic feel. And I have very little control over that in the long run, although I am a consultant on the film. But I'm very much hoping that they pick a face both and actor, both East European and totally unfamiliar to all of us in the West. Because I think when you see someone you know very well from other movies in a role like this, for one thing, it's not scary. And for another thing, it just doesn't have the feel of someone who is truly coming out of a tradition that this book is trying to use.
We have a question. Thank you.
Hi, Elizabeth. I was just curious. I have a question about the length of the book. You know, we hear a lot, especially from, you know, editors and literary agents and publishers, you know, with the costs of book becoming so great these days, especially when it comes down to fiction. You hear a lot about having to cut it down, having to keep it brief, having to keep it concise. I mean, look at the Da Vinci Code, one of the biggest fiction books this time. It's a tiny book. Chapters are 3 pages long. I mean, it's a really good example of a brief, brief book. And I was curious, did you get any kind of pressure from publishers or editors or agents to cut it down a bit or trim it down a bit or anything like that?
It was originally 3,000 pages.
You must be a writer. Yes, these are always concerns when you send out a long manuscript. And I was worried about that but determined not to, to cut my story. I will say that originally my manuscript was 1,100 pages. And I trimmed it myself to 900 before I sent it out. And novels are mailed out by agents in boxes, kind of typing paper boxes. And this one went out in 2 boxes instead of 1, which made my agent nervous, I think. But to my great joy, the editor who took the book actually, although she wanted me to make some small changes and sort of replace some scenes, move things around a little bit, she didn't want big cuts. She read it a second time and said, you know, I don't know what you would cut here, really. This is the whole story. This is what it needs to be. And it's part of that tradition of the long 19th century novel. These novels used to be published in 3 volumes, and there was a reason for that. And so the final published book is only came out of a manuscript, a final manuscript that was only 6 pages different from what I had submitted. I was very happy about that. Yeah.
I'm sure there wasn't any, nobody argued with you about having the maps in there, right, which I consulted, you know, dozens of times.
I'm so pleased they put those in, yeah, yep.
Good afternoon. You talked about how it took 10 years to write this. My question is, why did it take so long, and more importantly, how did you know when you were done?
2 very good questions, and as I've said, I ask myself the first one sometimes. It took this long because I was a working instructor, partly. I was writing, like most fiction writers, I was unable to and not trying to make a living from writing. So I often had to write late at night or get up very early in the morning or take a notebook on my lunch break. And I learned to work on it in sometimes very short stints. Sometimes I'd have 20 minutes at a time. And so that was a long process, partly because of it. And the other reason was the research. A book with a lot of research behind it takes a long time to generate, because first you're doing research to get background, and then you're realizing you need very specific answers to particular questions. You know, what were people wearing on the streets of Istanbul in 1954? And it takes a long time to find the answers to those. So I was constantly both writing and researching. And can you tell me your second question?
The second question was, how did you know when you were through?
Oh, well, I knew I was through because I had outlined a lot of the second part of the book. So near the end, I knew I had to write to the end of particular scenes and get to the end of what I intended to have happen in the story. So it was very clear to me when I had written the last word. And it was an electrifying moment after 10 years.
As a University of Michigan graduate, I was interested in the fact that you got your MFA there, and I'm wondering how your time in Ann Arbor contributed to your book, if it did, and that you got a Hopwood Award for a novel in progress, and I assume it was for this.
Yes, my University of Michigan experience, and I'm glad to meet a fellow alum, was wonderful. I went there to graduate school after I had worked on the book for 8 years. I really wanted to have spent some time in a writing community and also to have some time when my writing would be funded rather than marginalized in my life. And so I spent the last 2 years I worked on the book in this graduate program, and it was a fantastic experience. It actually took a little while for me to kind of come out of the closet with my Dracula manuscript in a writing workshop, because I had secret fears that it might be dismissed as genre work or commercial work, although to me it's a very literary novel. And I found when I finally got the courage to bring it to workshop that I got wonderful critique and help, fabulous help from faculty and from fellow students. And I sometimes think if I hadn't gone to that program, it might have taken me another 10 years to finish this up.
When you were traveling in the Balkans and writing The Historian, did you ever become interested in the later era of history where America was at war with the Romanians and the Bulgarians and over 1,000 American airmen died? Did that part of history interest you too?
I'm very interested in 20th century history. And one of the really difficult decisions that I made in this book was not to write about World War II, which is an era that deeply interests me. In fact, my uncle, who is a very close friend of mine and one of the models, partial models, for some of the most admired male characters in this book, was a bomber pilot in World War II and flew over Romania. And we were very lucky we didn't lose him there. As you say, so many American airmen never came back from those missions. I felt that if I tried to write about World War II, I would have to assemble a kind of profound knowledge about that era that it would really deserve and that I don't have. It's such an enormous, important topic. So I did not tackle it in this book. But as you know, there are echoes of the war in the book. There are scenes before and after it. So, for example, in Budapest, the American character sees bullet holes in some of the buildings, which were still there in 1954. There was a tremendous rebuilding of Eastern Europe and of course, a tremendous rebuilding of the lives of Americans who had been so affected by that era. But that's a wonderful question. It was something I struggled with when I was deciding when to set the different parts of the book.
I know you're working on your next book now, and I was thinking about the differences that must have taken place since then. I've read references to the fact that, I mean, really you were living quite close to the bone, you and your family, and that you couldn't afford to buy more than 3 books a year. You couldn't buy the really nice pajamas that you wanted to buy. I mean, things that they're very personal, but they're sweet, too, that you really worked hard. You put your entire soul and life into this thing, and then it was a huge success. But the next book now is going to be written under very different circumstances, and I'm wondering how the success of something like this changes the next one. I mean, do you feel like you're under a different kind of pressure, and are you looking forward to it? Are you going into the same kind of historical depth, all these things? And you have 2 minutes.
I'm not sure I can remember that in 2 minutes, but it's a great question. As all of you who are writers know, the greatest luxury for a serious writer is time to write, and it's the thing that we all struggle for. So I feel incredibly fortunate to have unexpectedly the ability to spend more of my time writing. Right now I'm traveling a great deal because of this book, and so I actually have less time to write right now, but eventually I will be able to write for a while without doing other things, which is something I've never experienced as a writer. I've always worked very hard at jobs. The new book, it's true that when you have one book that's been unexpectedly a public success, there's a certain pressure on the next book. But I have found that when I actually sit down to write, all of that falls away again. I wrote this book for my own pleasure, first and foremost. I never expected to necessarily even be able to publish it. And I was determined to finish it because I cared about it. When I work now, it takes a little bit longer for the rest of the world to drop away. But again, I'm alone with my characters. I'm absorbed in this process. And every writer and reader knows that that is what really counts in this business.
Well, unfortunately, I'm going to have to let you go. I do have dozens of more questions, but I want you – you're taking off to London this afternoon because you're up for yet another award. You just won a huge one in Spain. The list is going on with The Historian. We look forward to the movie. And Elizabeth Kostova, thank you so much, and good luck with you.
Thank you so much for having me here today.
Thank you all for being here for Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman.
You've been listening to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, a contributor to WTTW 11's Chicago Tonight and Artbeat. Victoria Lautman has written articles for the Chicago Tribune, USA Today, The Reader, and the Chicago Sun-Times. She's been the Chicago editor for Metropolitan Home, Art and Auction, and Architectural Record, and has also contributed pieces to many other magazines, including Interview, El Decor, and Architectural Digest. Writers on the Record will return on Sunday, April 30th, when Victoria's guest will be Jay McInerney, author of The Good Life. If you'd like to be in the audience for that discussion, please call 312-832-6789 to make a reservation. Admission is free. Our special thanks to everyone at Looking Glass Theater, including Executive Director Rachel Kraft, General Manager John Obligato, and Director of Production Alex Blunt, and to Chicago Magazine, including Editor Richard Babcock. Eric Arunas is the audio engineer for Writers on the Record. Dennis Moore directed the broadcast. Steve Robinson is the executive producer. Host and producer for Writers on the Record is Victoria Lautman. We hope you've enjoyed Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman. Today's broadcast was made possible in part by the Seminary Co-op Bookstores.